Yo, we back. Welcome back to the Only Chip and the Cookie podcast. I'm your host, aka I'm your guy, I'm your bro, I'm your friend, Larry from Iowa. First and foremost, I want to shout out everybody that's been listening to the podcast. I've been getting a lot of awesome feedback, lots of great things have been said about the podcast so far. Definitely motivates me to keep going. Also, I've gotten a lot of great critique and some tips as well that I'm going to try my best to apply as well to help enhance the podcast. And so I've been reading all the emails. I've been listening to the messages that you guys have been sending me, and I just really appreciate all the love. So thank you so much. This is our second episode, and today we're going to talk about politics a little bit, and not necessarily who to vote for per se if you are leaning left or leaning right, but more so talking about politics on a local level. My inspiration for talking about politics today has come from the increasing demand in Kentucky to bring justice to Breonna Taylor. For those of you that aren't familiar with the story, my first question is, have you been living under a rock? Breonna Taylor was a young EMT who one evening she was asleep in bed with her partner. I don't remember if it was a boyfriend, fiance, husband, or what, but she was in bed with her partner, and the police busted down the door and just started blasting shots on the suspicion of basically they were executing a warrant, but come to find out they were actually at the wrong house. And as they were just blindly shooting in the bedroom, they fatally struck Breonna Taylor. So basically there has been no real accountability for this air quote mistake that took place. One of the main calls right now is to look into reopening or prosecuting the individuals that murdered Breonna Taylor. And I've been seeing a lot of calls to contact the Attorney General's office in Kentucky. And it just got me to think, I wonder if folks understand why that is important, why it would be important to contact an Attorney General. And then it got me thinking about, you know, the fact that my state, Iowa, we had the Iowa primaries about 6 or 7 weeks ago. And as I was looking at my ballot, I'm not going to lie to you guys, I didn't quite understand the different positions that I was voting for. And I kind of felt like I was doing myself and my community a disservice by just kind of blindly checking names in a box. Yep, that's what I did. Since then, I've made it a point to educate myself a little bit more on this process. And so I brought on a guest. His name is Isaiah McGee, and he is a friend of mine, someone that works in the diversity and inclusion arena. He also has some experience with local politics. I figured he would be a great guest to have on the show to break down some of those things. So we will hear from Isaiah in a little bit later on in the podcast. So we are coming off of the 4th of July holiday, or as some of us refer to it as, 15 days after Juneteenth. And, you know, it's interesting because now we are seeing, some of us anyway, are seeing in our social media circles lots of reposts of the Frederick Douglass essay, "What is the 4th of July to the Negro?" A lot of folks are saying things like, you know, "I better not catch you in red, white, and blue this year." And I mean, I get it. I totally understand where that's coming from. And also, I understand how some folks can have a struggle with really breaking down what the 4th of July meant to certain individuals in this country, specifically the black folk. And so, if you've grown up your whole life having fun and experiencing joy on the 4th of July, some of you guys are sitting at home or were sitting, just kind of scratching your heads, like, what do I do this year? Right? And it wouldn't be a Larry from Iowa story if I could not only relate, but also have kind of an extreme example of this whole situation. So my wife actually, her birthday just happens to fall on the 4th of July. So every 4th of July, ever since we've had a family anyway, has always been kind of a big deal. 'Cause now we can have a festival, festive type of situation, and then also celebrate mom slash wifey's birthday. So that's always kind of been a thing. And this year, my wife was super conflicted. She's like, I love getting the kids dressed up on the 4th of July and taking a picture. But I mainly like doing it because it's my birthday. And me, on the other hand, I'm like, man, you're not going to catch me in some red, white, and blue this year. But it led to a discussion between us. And look, this is kind of what I came up with. Looking back, for me anyway, the 4th of July was simply a day off. It was a time to get together with family that you haven't seen in a while, and it was an opportunity to really kick off your summer if the month of June went by and you didn't really do too much, right? So, bam, we've got the 4th of July cookout. And, did I grow up with folks wearing red, white, and blue on the 4th of July? I don't know, maybe, right? But I don't recall my parents ever really being like, today we're celebrating America's freedom. No, it was, today we're going to grandpa's house. You're going to see all your cousins. You're going to play, you're going to kick it, we're going to light fireworks, firecrackers off. We're going to see the fireworks. We're going to eat good. When you grow up with black parents that are well versed in black history, when you grow up with parents that are open to talking about those kinds of things, it's like, it's just never you never really look at the 4th of July as a big deal anyway, right? So, and then we've learned. We were slow on this, y'all, but we learned about Juneteenth, right? So now Juneteenth is turning into our thing, right? And I wouldn't be surprised if Juneteenth turns into a federal holiday someday, because you already have companies now that are giving that day off to their employees, to all of their employees. So we got Juneteenth. That's a time for us to really celebrate our freedom and reflect, I believe, right? But I feel like, I just feel like as far as the 4th of July goes, moving forward for me, it's always going to be my wife's birthday. So it's always going to be a point for us to have the most fun, on that day as possible, or at least celebrate my wife, in the best way that I can on her birthday, right? Does that mean that you're gonna see your boy out in some Uncle Sam hats? Hell no. And like I said, I never really got into dressing up in red, white, and blue on the 4th of July, but I remember maybe about 3 years back, I bought this awesome polo. And it's got these little micro American flags all over it. And My consciousness really started to awake shortly after the time that I wore that, shortly after the time that I bought that polo. And I just know that, I don't know. I'm not trying to, I just don't feel comfortable. I don't feel comfortable. It has nothing to do with my thoughts on what someone might think about me if I wear an American flag, but when you just realize, and you have this awakening of how your people have been treated decade after decade, century after century, it's just kind of hard to wrap that flag around you. That's all I'm saying. So look, keep having fun on the 4th. See the fireworks. From a, when you can do it safely, of course. Do those things that make you happy and do it in your own way. And I had alluded earlier to the Frederick Douglass essay. Before we jump into this conversation with Isaiah McGee, I want to play a version of this essay for you. This is the people reciting this essay are actually descendants of Frederick Douglass, and so I am going to insert that clip right now. Please take a listen to it and reflect on the words. And then after that, we will jump right into this awesome conversation with Isaiah McGee as we talk about local politics.
This is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and of your political freedom.
Fellow citizens, I shall not presume to dwell at length on the associations that cluster about this day. The simple story of it is that 76 years ago, the people of this country were British subjects.
Oppression makes a wise man mad. Your fathers were wise men, and if they did not go mad, they became restive under this treatment.
With brave men, there's always a remedy for oppression.
They succeeded, and today you reap the fruits of their success. The freedom gained is yours. And you, therefore, may properly celebrate this anniversary.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence?
Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us?
I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary.
Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common.
The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me.
The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me.
This 4th of July is yours, not mine.
You may rejoice, I must mourn.
Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions.
At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed.
Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke.
For it is not light that is needed, but fire.
It is not the gentle shower, but thunder.
We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake.
The feeling of the nation must be quickened.
The conscience of the nation must be roused.
The propriety of the nation must be startled.
The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed.
And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim.
To him, your celebration is a sham.
Your boasted liberty, an unholy license.
Your national greatness, swelling vanity.
Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless.
Your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence.
Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery.
Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings.
With all your religious parade and solemnity are to him
mere bombast,
fraud,
deception,
impiety,
and hypocrisy. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour.
All right, so welcome back to the Only Chip in the Cookie podcast. And we are joined today by a very special guest. This guy is a very, very close friend of mine. I've known him for a long time. His name is Isaiah McGee. And before Isaiah jumps in, I just want to tell you a little bit about him. Basically, look, I'll just make this short. Long story short, Isaiah has made a career out of talking to organizations and individuals about how they can better incorporate diversity and equity within their lives, within their organizations, their classrooms. And he actually does what I would consider to be my dream job, right? So, and then on top of that, I know that Isaiah has a some history with the political world as well. In fact, when I met him, he was a councilman in a community that we had both lived in at the time. And so I thought that now would be a great time to bring Isaiah on, as we talk a lot and as we learn a lot about some of the political happenings that are happening in local communities and things like that. And I was hoping that we could bring in an expert here to help us kind of get a better understanding of how our local government works for us and just what we can do to better align ourselves with allies. So without any further ado, that was a pretty lengthy introduction. Without any further ado, give it up for my man, Isaiah McGee. What's going on, Isaiah?
What's going on, Larry? I appreciate you having me on, and congratulations on getting this thing started here.
Hey, no problem, man. And I appreciate it. And so Isaiah, first things first, man. So the name of this podcast is The Only Chip in the Cookie.
Yep.
And it's one of those names that I was hoping could kind of go without an explanation. You know, you either get it or you don't, right?
Yeah.
So before we really jump into all of these political questions that I have for you and all that stuff, I gotta ask, man, can you share with me maybe some experiences that you've had where you were the only one?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I think the topic at hand that we're going to be talking about here today and the overall broad scope of your podcast, I think they're intertwined, or they're very closely related, because that is my experience. You know, I grew up in LA, in South Central LA, during the time of NWA and Tupac and the LA riots and the OJ Simpson trial and all that type of stuff. And then I came out to Iowa because I was fortunate enough to be decent enough in sports that I used that as an opportunity to go to college. So I went to a small college in eastern Iowa, moved out to Colorado for a couple of years, and then came back to Iowa to go to grad school. So all of my professional career, most of my professional career has been where I've been that one cookie, or I've been that one chocolate chip in the cookie.
Yeah.
So I get it. I understand what you're talking about. And I think that's been really, for me, my perspective along the type of work that I do now. I didn't start off wanting to necessarily do diversity work or be a diversity consultant or anything like that. I actually tried to avoid it. But as I continue to look at the way society is structured and opportunities for me and how I saw myself and some of the barriers to that and the barriers for other people and how we are always looking to create opportunities, but it's typically at the expense of being able to be our full and authentic selves. That's where I got started getting more involved in and doing the work that I do now, which is how to confront these inequities and try to work with people on both the interpersonal ways to deal with those, but also systemically what we can do to dismantle that as well.
Yeah, man, I actually related quite a bit to what you said there. I never thought in a million years that I would want to pursue that path either. I always thought I was going to be either a bank manager forever or, you know, maybe human resources. But I think the more I experience certain inequities, you know, the more it kind of motivated me to kind of dig a little bit deeper and find out why those things are happening. And now I'm to the point where it's like, okay, I need to take these experiences and take these tools that I'm discovering and do something with this. And you're absolutely right. And like I said earlier, I mean, you've been down this path, for a while now, certainly, setting the way for brothers like me to even realize that's even a possibility, to even pursue that kind of thing. So that's awesome. So like I said, you know, when I met you, you know, speaking of diversity stuff, so I was working for a company at the time, and I believe there was something being sponsored by the local NAACP, and it was one of those situations where it was like, hey, you're the black dude that works for the company. We need you to go here and represent us, right? And me being, you know, 21 years old, I kind of just did whatever. I ended up going to this function. You were there. And so not only did I see another chip in the cookie, but we also, this event, I believe it was either in the suburb that we lived in, or perhaps you were just talking about where you were from.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was, yeah. you mentioned where you were from, and I kind of remember doing a double take, because I was like, I thought there was only two of us, and then,
yeah.
and the other one I knew lived around the corner from me, so
right. Yeah.
So I think I was super excited about that when I heard that, and
same.
I think that's been the most interesting experience for me has been, and this is why I say everywhere I go now, I have the good fortune of being able to travel around the country now doing this work, and oftentimes I find myself in places that are largely and predominantly white,
mm-hmm.
and I remind them, it's like there's always, even in some of the most white spaces, there are people of color there, mm-hmm. and their experience matters to them. And you'll hear me say this a lot, that our perspectives are birthed from our experiences. So the way that we see the world comes from the way that we experience the world.
Yeah.
And so when you're a person of color, it doesn't matter. How we go about trying to integrate or assimilate into the culture or the environment that we're in. The old saying is when in Rome, do as the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
None of that matters, because it doesn't matter what your philosophy or your perspective on that is. There are still people who look at you differently. And because of the way that they look at you differently, they are placing you into a certain box. And because of that box, they have ascribed a certain value to your experience.
Yeah.
So that's where the problem typically comes in. It's not that they necessarily think that you have to do things their way, but mm-hmm. when you don't do things in that particular way, is there a devaluing of that experience? Is there, do they look at your experience and your perspective from that experience and say that it is inferior to the experiences that they've had. And many people will say, "Oh, absolutely not. I don't think that." Mm-hmm. But we, as a part of our nature, is to seek comfort. And so, as we're seeking out comfort, then that's how we're going to make decisions. When we're hiring people, when we're associating with people, when we're all these different types of things that we're doing, we look at and say, "I trust people who have similar experiences to me." Right. And if I trust them, then I'm willing to give them more of the benefit of the doubt compared to someone who I have a harder time relating to or understanding their experience. So yeah. I don't think most people, there are people who definitely do look at someone and say, "Oh, that person's black," or "that person's brown," or "that person's a person of color, and I don't like them simply because of that." There are people that are like that, but that's not the majority of people. The problem really is when we talk about systemic racism, it's how we look at and say, "I'm more comfortable around this environment with these people who have similar experiences to me compared to folks that do not have the same experiences or perspectives that I do."
I'm more comfortable. I'm more inviting. I'm more accepting. I'm more likely to hire. I'm more likely mm-hmm. to promote. Yeah, it all kind of circles around that. That comfort level kind of dictates your willingness to give someone else an opportunity.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so then the end result of that becomes these inequities that we see, where I always remind people, like when people talk about like the violence that's going on in society right now, geared mm-hmm. towards Black people, mainly in the hands of folks that are charged with enforcing the law, and then the reaction that we've seen recently to that, the issue isn't, sometimes it's framed up as, well, you know, there's just this, there are a few bad apples. It's not an issue of there being a few more. There's more bad apples than I think we realize. That's the first thing. But the question I throw out is, how do you determine what's good and what's bad? Mm-hmm. Because if you take the stance of well, sometimes, you know, good people do bad things, the inverse is also true, and that is that sometimes bad people do good things. And so how do you determine what makes a person fully good or fully bad? We all do good things and bad things. George Washington owned slaves, was not very good to his slaves. At the same time, he was a masterful politician, was a masterful military leader. And so how do we determine then that person's legacy? What we do is we have to incorporate all of it. We have to look at it holistically and take the good and the bad. And we can't sugarcoat one or the other.
Can I just say one thing about George Washington? When I was in first grade, I went to Mount Vernon. And we were given a tour, of course, of the whole plantation. And there was a part, and I was with my family, there was a part where we got to like this, we were in one of the cabins and or one of the houses or whatever. There was this rocking chair contraption kind of thing, and it had a whip attached to the back of it and a pedal on the front of it. So if a slave needed to get whooped, it could literally from the comfort of this rocking chair press its foot down like a gas pedal, and this whip would come from behind the chair and over the top of it and whip the slave, right? And I remember when the tour guy was describing that, like, the room kind of erupted in laughter, and I'm freaking 6 years old, and bro, I've hated George Washington ever since. I've hated him ever since.
those are the types of things I think we need to know, because what happens is when we whitewash things too much, when we romanticize things too much, here's my perspective, and this kind of gets into the political conversation. And I posted something online the other day from James Baldwin, who is one of my favorite authors. And he talks about, you know, because he loves his country so much, that's the reason why he critiques it the way that he does. It's not because he doesn't love the country. It's because he wants the country to be the best that it can be. And here's the thing, the way I frame it up is, when you look at the words of the Constitution, They are beautiful words, very masterful words. And when you think about the idea of the Declaration of Independence and the ideals that are instilled within those documents, those are masterful pieces that I think we should honor and think and consider. But we also have to look at and say, all right, these words say this, but that's not what we're doing. And so if this is not what we're doing, then what can we continually do to improve upon that so that our actions match up with our words? And so when we look at and we romanticize our history and even the figures in history, including the people who wrote those documents and were key individuals in instilling and enforcing those documents at the early stages of the country, we also have to point out where they were inconsistent as well. Because when doing so, then we can understand better on why we still struggle with some of those issues today. There's a reason why our country still has an issue with race. And it's not because of something inherently within Black people that makes it that way.
Right.
It's the way there's a systemic reason why we've been treated the way we have that goes back and forth through history. And until we understand why that is and why that's the reason and why it still persists, we can't really truly fulfill the ideals that we are founded on.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I love how you put that. If someone, and I'm glad that we were documenting this, because literally if someone were to rewind that, all these so-called patriots out there, you know, these people that are for America and wear their American flag shirts, and you know what they mean, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. If they really believed in that, then they would listen to those words and they would apply that.
Yep.
And that's, there's really no better way to put that. So like I said, so when I met you, you were a councilman, right?
Yeah.
You're probably the, you were probably the second, you're definitely the first local politician that I had ever really like kind of met. Right. So I think the very first politician that I met was Barbara Bush back in my Mount Vernon days. But I just remember, you know, it being, just, you know, real cool getting to know you and seeing that side of things. Right. But now, so fast forward, I've been thinking about something, Isaiah. So right now, in several cities throughout the world, we've got, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, and they are, demanding conversations with local elected officials. They're bringing specific policies and ideas for reform to the table. I have a lawyer friend who was telling me about a local ordinance that he and another lawyer friend were drafting up, and they were going to present it to their city council meeting. About 4 or 5 weeks ago, we had the Iowa primaries, right? And I'm not gonna lie, I look at my ballot, I have no idea what any of these titles are, what they do. But as I'm watching the TV and as I'm hearing these cries to reach out to the Attorney General in Kentucky with regards to the Breonna Taylor murder. And as I see on the protest in Minneapolis, they're talking to the mayor about defunding the police, which of course people don't understand what defunding the police means. They don't understand that this means a reallocation of funds or whatever, blah blah blah. But anyway, as I see these conversations happen, you know, when I was at the booth that, you know, the Iowa primaries, man, I felt kind of bad. I was like, man, now is the time for me to really exercise my, you know, whatever political muscle that I have, you know, by voting. But I don't really understand. Not only do I not know these people, but I don't even understand what positions they're running for.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know what? Let me get my man Isaiah McGee on the line. Let's talk about some of these local offices. And why they're important, what they do. Can you Can you take us a civics class, my man?
I will say we'll do a little remix of Schoolhouse Rocks here, and it won't be I'm Just a Bill, but because that's wrong anyway. But this is not it should someone should redo that one because it's not very accurate. That's the way I was always taught, and then I learned the system itself. I'm like, that's not how the system it works. Dang. But let me for your listeners, I'll give them just a little quick. A rundown of how I understand this stuff, and at least what came to my knowledge on it. So I've always loved history. I was just telling I was guest lecturing a class at Drake the other day, and I was telling them I remember being in third grade and reading through a textbook that we had in third grade social studies period or whatever you want to call it in elementary school, and I remember just reading it for fun. And it was a biography of different Americans. The book was called Our American Heritage. And Larry, let me tell you, man, this is the people that they had in this book. And I still love the book. I wasn't as aware of things today, but it's funny how this stuff still sticks in my head. The people that they had, most of the people in the book were white men, but they were smart enough that it was a pretty diverse book. They had a number of African Americans and women, white women, and some indigenous people in there as well too, but this is who they had in there. For the two black, the three black people that they had in there, where it was Martin Luther King, Booker T. Washington, and George Washington Carver. Hmm. And so you talk about trying to formulate kind of what they believe the black experience should be.
Yeah.
And the way that they describe those people. Yeah, I love Booker T. Washington. I think, you know, he's a great American. But
shout out George Washington Carver, Iowa State University.
Yeah, exactly. and that was the point. The point was to say, hey, look at these individuals and what they've done and how they assimilated into society. So that was the point of it. You know, it wasn't talking about Booker T. Washington as well as also talking about Marcus Garvey or W.E.B. It was really trying to frame it and say, oh, these are the good ones. I mean, they had two indigenous folks in there, Pocahontas and Squanto. Squanto helped the way they formed the conversation. Squanto really helped the Pilgrims make peace with the Indians, and he was one of the good ones, right? Mm. The women that they had in the book were out of all the people, all the great women in history, no stories about Harriet Tubman, no stories about the women who helped do women's suffrage. None of those folks. Who they focused on was Laura Ingalls Wilder, who wrote the book Little Women, and Clara Barton, who started the American Red Cross. So you talk about even at the age of third grade. Texts that were trying to help formulate how we saw history in a particular way, that speaks volumes.
Yeah.
And here I am in third grade and I love this stuff. And I still, even to this day, I still find our romanticized history of America, I find it entertaining. I'm also smart enough to understand that those are romanticized stories and that they are what they are. They're meant to elicit a certain emotion. Even now, I love the musical and now the movie Hamilton. Love it. My kids love it. We know all the words. I think it's a great. I think it's great for a number of reasons, including the fact that it brings in a hip hop to a different level for a dominant audience that maybe that doesn't always understand or doesn't feel like they can relate or get rap music. And so the fact that now there's a play that kind of incorporates this in a very unique way, I think it's great. But it's also a romanticized story. And we talk about George, we just talked about George Washington. There's no conversation about the fact that George Washington owned slaves and that he didn't really treat them very well.
Yeah.
Or even a couple of characters on there like Hercules. He was a spy, but he was a spy who had one of his slaves was instrumental in making his spy network work. Cato. And so those types of stories, the more I learn about them, actually, the more it makes me even more excited about history. So for me, as I started learning history over and over again, I started getting really excited about the process, and because a lot of our history that we learn in school is political.
Yeah.
History. We learn about presidents, we learn about wars, we learn about elections and those types of things. And so as I learned how that machine works, it's just like science. It's just like learning how any type of machine works. I got excited about seeing how those things work overall. And so when I got into college, I actually started looking at how it worked at a different level. And I ran for the student council in my college at different levels. And I had a blast with it. That was so fun that I knew that I saw the impact of the work that I was able to accomplish there too. I saw that how it made my college a better place, and I saw how different philosophies and perspectives and even new policies that we actually got passed, how they affected the student body population and the college overall. And it made me want to then go ahead and take that to a different level as well too. So when I became an adult, I started doing the same thing, and I was like, I didn't really think that I was ever going to, I maybe thought I would do it. I was like, oh, that would kind of be fun to do. But I'll need to wait till I'm like 40 or 45 before I end up doing anything like that. And then when I ended up running, it was because the year prior to that, someone thought it would be a good idea to bring in a project into the community that I didn't think was a healthy project for the community. And I started, speaking out against it. And someone asked, like, hey, we like the way you articulated this. Would you be willing to speak out on it a little bit more? And so I started doing that. And the more I did it, we started organizing a campaign around it and getting other citizens involved with it. That led to the following year, someone saying, you know, there's an opening on the city council. You really should run for it. And I'm like, you know, I was 25 at the time, dude. And so it was, I was like, nah, I can't do it. But then I started seeing some of the other people who were in these positions. And this is the thing that I will say to any folks. We have, a lot of times we revere some of our politicians and we put them on these pedestals, but they're regular people.
Yeah.
Particularly at the local levels and even the state level, like in state politics. These are regular people who drink coffee and tea like the rest of us do.
I was just thinking, I was just going to say, when I go to my 9-to-5 job, I often see Kim Reynolds there, you know, at the Starbucks getting her coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. It's these folks. And that's what I think the biggest thing that I learned. I remember being when someone was still trying to kind of get me to think about this stuff, they actually helped me go on a trip. And it was a trip of local leaders, business leaders, and political leaders. They would go out to Washington, D.C. And I was like, oh, I love Washington, D.C. I want to go out there. So they helped sponsor me to go out there. And I'm out there with all of these leaders. And that's when it hit me. I was like, they're no different than I am. And not just in terms of what we do, but also even the way that we understand issues. Some folks are very brilliant minds. And some folks are still developing their thoughts on things as well too, but they might be nice and personable people. And we have the tendency to think that everyone who's in elected office are these perfect people or these very sophisticated and smart people. That's not always the case. Sometimes they're just folks that were willing to represent their community, and they had the time, they had the energy, they were passionate enough to want to do it, and enough people got behind them to support them, and then they got more people behind them to support them once they were in office.
Yeah. So when you so break it down for me. Right. So you're a city councilman, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does that role look like, and how do you interact with your, is it a constituency at this point, right?
Yeah, it is. But it is probably between that and school board, it's as local as you can get. So mm-hmm. It's not like people are, these are not career positions where you're making a huge salary. School board, yeah. you don't make your school board, you don't make any money off of. Mm-hmm. City council is it's not, it's maybe enough to maybe pay a couple of utility bills. but it's not like you're making bank off of it.
Yeah. And so, right. Okay.
You know, most of these folks, even in the state legislature, most of these folks are average citizens who have other jobs, and that they also do this as part of their commitment to the community. And that's not always the case. There's always folks that maybe have an ulterior motive, in there. But for the most part, I think, that's how they look at it and that's how they approach it, is that they really just want, they have an opinion about something, and they're passionate enough about it, and they go out and they vote for it. They go out and they run for these offices. So at the local level, yes, you do have a constituency, but think about it as just a series of circles, maybe the mm-hmm. best way to describe it. So within the within one circle is a smaller circle, or one of those I forget what those dolls from Russia, the Troyeska dolls.
Sure.
There's always another one, a little smaller one.
I can't think of what they're called, but I know what you're talking about.
I think they're called Troyeska's dolls or something like that. But the idea is that it's the same thing in local government. There are regions that say we need someone to represent the voice of the people. We talk about democracy in the country. We're really not a democracy. We're a representative democracy. A full democracy would say that, hey, let's just take a vote of everybody, and then whatever the majority of people wants, let's just do that. We actually don't want that. And the reason why that is as the only chip in the cookie. Sometimes if you just go by the majority rules, then you're never going to have your voice or your space at the table. So what a representative democracy allows us to do is it allows that person to not only consider that of the majority, but also consider the rights of the minority as well too. So a person who's in a political office should always kind of be balancing the two, looking at both what the majority wants, but also what is fair for everyone, so that the minority doesn't get trampled on as well. And so when we vote for people, we're voting for someone to say, hey, I believe this person can do that. This person can consider the views of everyone who lives within this particular area, in this particular role, whether it is a school board, or whether it is a county supervisor, whether it's a city council member. Their job is to think about what rules do we need at this particular level for this function, how the school works, how the county works, how the city works, okay. how the state works. And then we also have the executive positions that go along with that. So at the city level, you have a mayor. The mayor's job is to help enforce the rules of the city. How do I execute the rules of the city? Maybe it's by ensuring that we have a police force. Maybe it's by going out and being the chief cheerleader of the city in different functions and different events. Maybe it is and creating certain committees so that we can think about other topics and making sure that we have more citizens involved in different places. Same thing at the state level. The state level then has the governor, and the governor's job is to execute the laws of the state. At the national level, we have the president. The president's job is to execute the laws at the national level. So at every level, we have roles of people who are there to represent the population. And then we have folks that are then in charge of executing whatever laws are created.
Yeah. So keeping it back to the local side of things. One, so in some cities, some mayors are called city managers. Is that right? Is that a thing, or is that something sort of different?
It's different. So think about it this way. because mayors are there's kind of two ways of looking at it. So you have representatives, and then you actually have people who are in charge of actually doing the work. Okay. And so think about it this way. You may have
some are more symbolic. You have symbolism, yeah. And then you've got the people that are actually doing the.
Yeah. So a city manager gets paid to manage the city. It's almost the difference between like having the president of a company and then the manager of that division. So a lot of times, for instance, like at a city level, you have the city manager. At the state level, you have the chief of staff. Even at the federal level, you have a chief of staff. They're the ones that say, all right, the mayor, the governor, the president wants to do this. He's hired you all to help get this stuff done. My job is to make sure you do it, and to see how you're doing it, and to make sure that we can respond at the local level, to make sure we can respond to both the mayor and the city council that you've done the things that they've asked you to do. So they are career people. When you're a city manager, you have chosen for that to be your career, your job. You've gone to school, probably in city planning or city engineering. You've studied this. You've played SimCity a number of times to manage all those types of things. You've done all these different types of things to make you understand how that works. Sometimes where there becomes a rub is city planners and city managers and city staff. This is their job, so they study this stuff, and they're thinking about it from a standpoint of maybe holistically to say, all right, I think if we do this, this is the outcome that we're going to get. And sometimes that is in conflict of maybe what people in the neighborhoods actually want, or how they perceive or how the impact of certain policies might be having. So I noticed, like when I was on the city council, for instance, sometimes we would have situations where the city was planning on doing something and the citizens would find out about it, and they were like, whoa, 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 we don't like this. We don't want this. And they would come to us as city council members or even to the mayor. And then our job is to take that in and to advocate on their behalf on that, to say, hey, you know, this might have this impact on this group of people, or these people are upset. That doesn't always necessarily mean that we have to respond and give those citizens exactly what they're wanting. But we need to be able to share their grievance with the city, and particularly with the staff, to say, Why are we doing things this way? I know you are the content expert. I know you went to school. You have a degree in this area, but this is the emotional impact that this might have on this family. This family was planning on doing this, and now by us putting in this particular policy or ordinance or rule, this is the impact it might have on them. So maybe we should think of a different way. If your goal is to create this, maybe we can wait, or maybe we should do something different, or I need better language so that I can go back and talk to that person so that they can better understand why we're doing this particular policy.
Okay. That's very helpful. You're already clearing up a lot of misconceptions I have had, and a lot of questions that I've had. So let's talk more on the legal side of things, right? So let's say you live in a city, and you feel like something isn't right. Maybe you feel like the police treated you bad, or something along that lines, And I know that recently. There have been folks here running for positions. I think Attorney General might have been one that I've seen, or maybe what's DA, District Attorney,
Yeah, District Attorney, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So can you talk to me a little bit about positions like that and how they affect communities?
So if you the term that people like to throw out, it's not just a popular TV show, but it's the term law and order, right? There's a reason why those two terms go together. It's because they're intertwined. So the idea that we have, we've agreed to as a society, is that we are willing to have these representatives that we talked about, and those representatives will then go out and create certain laws, and those laws need to be enforced. Most communities have decided the way that we will try to enforce those laws at their greatest degree is through a some type of law enforcement, some type of peacekeeping force. So most laws, you can go to someone's door, knock on the door, someone from the city can say, hey, you're not supposed to have a pool in your backyard without a fence, or something like that. You need to do that or you're going to get fined. All right, that's fine. But sometimes there might be situations where it requires more than that. If someone is driving recklessly, you might need some different type of enforcement for that or something. So what cities have created in large part is a force, a police force, that is charged with enforcing those particular laws. What happens with that then is then it also goes and is connected to everyone. We have a system in our Constitution that says if you are charged with breaking a law, you have an opportunity to plead your case or to make your case that you didn't do it, or that there's a misunderstanding in how it was enforced, or there's a rationale that is consistent with it not actually being a breaking of the law. That's why we have a court system. The court system and the police system are not completely separate. They're still intertwined. People don't think a lot of times realize how often and how closely related the police and the county attorney's offices work together, or the district attorney offices work together. Because when a police pulls over someone or arrests someone and decides that they're basically saying this person broke a law, and then the county has to decide if this person broke the law, we need to make the case that this person broke the law. So there's going to be an intertwining between the county attorney's office, who has the responsibility to represent the county, or at the state level, the attorney general, or even at the national level, the attorney general of the United States. They have a job, a responsibility to say, these people are breaking the law, and this is the effect that it has on this particular entity, whether it's the nation, the state, or the county. So as citizens, we also get a voice in who those people are too. We get to choose who the county attorney is. At the state level, we get to choose who the attorney general is. At the national level, we choose the president, who then gets to choose his cabinet, which includes the attorney general. So the intertwining of that is when we feel like the police forces are not being fair, or are abusing their power, or maybe have biases that are having them enforce the law differently towards different populations, or more strictly to certain populations and more flexible to other populations, then what we can do is think about where is the power lie for them. So that's why you see a lot of these defund movements, for instance, going on right now, where they're saying, well, let's go to the people who fund the police in the first place. Who gives the police their power? Someone gives them their power. They're not just vigilantes, most of them.
And I think two-thirds of municipality budgets? Is it two-thirds or one-third?
Yeah, so it's something like that. It's a very large number.
Yeah.
And part of that is you're talking about human resources, right? So when you when you're talking about the cost of, and it's a inherently dangerous job. So you're talking about hiring someone. You have to incentivize it enough that you make people want to do it because of how dangerous it is. And then because of how dangerous it is, or can be, I should say, then you also have to consider what happens when that person decides to leave this profession or retire from the profession. So there's a number of different things that make it expensive. Human resources is always going to be a high number. but it doesn't always have to be so. Part of it is, in my opinion, we make it a little too easy for people to enter into this profession. Like, my background is in education, it's not in criminal justice. But it's the same thing we advocate for in the education field as well too. And that is, sometimes we make it a little too easy for individuals to get into a profession that has a high degree of complexity and a high degree of sensitivity as well too. There's a lot of people who want to be who are concerned about health, but not everyone who's concerned about health should be a doctor, right? Not everyone who's concerned about health should be a nurse. Or there's different degrees of nursing, and there's different degrees of being able to be the different types of doctors. The problem within education and in the police force is the way that we allow people to enter into those forces. We're asking, to be fair to them, we're asking both of them to do a lot of work. So if you become a teacher, you're being asked to do a lot more than just teach. Yeah. If you're asked to be a police officer, if you want to be a police officer, you're asked to do a lot more than just keep the peace. And so in some cases, when we talk about the bad apples per se, in some cases, it when you keep the criteria very minimal for people to get involved, it invites certain people who
exactly.
Who may not necessarily shouldn't necessarily be involved with it.
Yeah.
If someone,
let's think, I mean, not to stereotype here, but you know, for a lot of us, you know, if there's inner biases that we have, a lot of us kind of have this impression that your typical person that becomes a cop is that person that wasn't very popular in school, maybe got picked on. And so they join this profession to kind of overcompensate, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm just kind of generalizing, but that's the thing. If the bar is set so low, then it invites, you know, jugheads like that.
It invites that type of person. There's certainly a number of people who don't fit that description.
Absolutely.
But it definitely invites those that do. Mm-hmm. Particularly because and that's why I'm very careful about the words that I choose here and looking at it as someone who's in charge of keeping the peace versus someone who is enforcing the law.
Right.
Because if you're the type of person that says, "Oh, I get to enforce the law," that invites a person who wants to have power, and maybe they do from a different standpoint. Maybe if you're always picked on when you were a kid or something like that, and now maybe you want to stand up to bullies, you want to stand up to people who are treating other people wrong. I think that's okay to do. Same thing with teachers. There's some folks who say, "Look, I had a great school experience. It was a good experience for me and a good environment for me, and I want to go back and give back to that." At the same time, too, the experience that you had, and then going into that environment, you start realizing, "Oh, that was my experience. Now, am I trying to force other people to have the same type of experience that I had, even though they have a different life experience and a different perspective than I might have had?" And that's typically what's happening in both of these professions, is we have a certain way of looking at things, again, our perspectives are birthed from our experiences. So what happens is we have this experience, which creates this perspective. We go into these fields, and then now we're in a more diverse environment where we're around people with multiple levels of lived experiences that are different than our own. And we have a certain level of power to ourselves, and it's easy to make those people force people to comply into that way. And that's where it becomes dangerous, because it doesn't have to be that way. We can go into, there are a number of different folks that follow a community policing model that says you can always get people to, you'll make a neighborhood safer, you'll make a school safer when you share power and you share agency. And the work that I do, we talk about this through restorative justice, this idea that if you, a teacher doesn't always have to have all the power. Their job is to facilitate their learning process. So you incorporate the experiences of the students involved, give them a little bit of a responsibility, show them how to use that responsibility, and they typically respond very well in those cases. Same thing in terms of policing. When you think about the community policing model, if you're out in the community and you get to know the folks that are out there and they see you as someone who truly cares about them, they feel safer around. They feel safer when you're around. A lot of times when we talk about in areas where no one wants to talk to the police and no one wants to quote unquote snitch and the police feel like their job is harder to actually do their job in those particular neighborhoods, which only then affects the neighborhood even worse because it invites more crime. The reason why that exists is because those people, it's not like they're saying they don't want the police there. They're saying, no, we can't trust you when you are here. So bad things happen, and then you come in and you're just as corrupt as the people who are, in some cases, you're just as corrupt as the people who are committing some of these crimes in the first place. So maybe I'm better off on my own without saying anything to anybody on this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's where this distrust comes from. The more we can create an environment where there's trust involved, the better the situation is going to be. And the only way you can do that is for those who are already in these positions, for instance, police, is if they get a little bit more uncomfortable with their own biases and get more involved with understanding the perspectives and the lived experiences of the people who are different than them. For those of us in the community, whether we're in a largely or predominantly Black community or community of color, or those of us who are the only chips in the cookie, what we have to do is still understand how these rules are applied to us and start getting active, which means we also have to do a little bit of understanding those that are different than us but being still comfortable with our own experiences and not shying away from those experiences, but also saying it doesn't have to be separate. I intertwine my experiences all the time. So when I was a city council member, what I did was I was still Black. I still liked Black things, whatever Black things are, you know, supposed to be. I still had my experiences growing up in LA that shaped the things that I liked and the things that I didn't like. But I also knew that if I was going to represent a group of people, I also had to understand what they valued and what they didn't value. And I also had to then consider and balance that with what are the things that they may not value and how might that have an impact on other folks that also choose this as a community that they want to live in.
Word. Well, Isaiah, I really appreciate all the time that you spent with us. And I know we just have a couple minutes left. But before we go, I just have to ask you, man. So everyone's going crazy over Kanye West saying that he's running for president. Now, me personally, I don't know a whole lot about politics, but I'm pretty sure there's a crap ton of forms and like stuff that he would actually have to do to actually make this happen. But yeah, I can't open up Facebook without every other status update, like people seriously talking about the impact that this guy is going to have as a candidate, as a whatever.
No, yeah.
So I need you to break it down, man. Is this for real or not, man? What's going on?
It's not for real. It's not legitimate. I will bet someone steak dinners for a month for a year if Kanye West wins the presidency. You're absolutely right. There are the rules. And there are the rules that are codified, that are written down, and then there are the unspoken rules. So, and this applies at all levels, at the local level, all the way up to the national level. If you want to know how something works, yes, there's the rules that are out there, but also study the history. Look at how it's worked for other people. History evolves, so there's always things that change. And even our current president didn't follow the most conventional route to the presidency, and certainly Kanye West is a extraordinary figure in our psyche for a number of different reasons. But there's certain things that you still have to do in order to prepare yourself for presidency. So here's the question I throw back at people is, why do you think this is happening? Why do you think that if he doesn't really have a clear pathway to become president, why is he running in the first place? What might be the motivations and the things that are going on, particularly mm-hmm. in light of what's going on in our world right now with all the racial injustice that's going on, that's been brought to the collective conscious of the nation? It's a distraction.
Yeah.
And I can still like his music and still say that it's a distraction due to the mm-hmm. distraction.
Yeah.
It's almost insulting, to be honest.
Yeah.
For some people to believe that because Kanye West is black and mm-hmm. and almost, and I don't want to say authentically black, that's a tough thing to define, but because he has the space and influence and resources within the black community, that there is all of a sudden going to be this movement towards him, different than the two candidates that are up, particularly Joe Biden, in this particular case. Let's not forget Kanye West is a friend of the president. So why would someone who's a friend of the president, even if they're an acquaintance, maybe not necessarily a close friend, but why would someone who's an acquaintance, why would they, in the middle of something, decide that, oh, I'm just going to run for president without a clear platform,
right?
Without being associated with either one of the political parties and the systems that the political parties have set up for choosing a nominee? Mm-hmm. All those types of things are out there. Are tells me that there's something else that's there.
Absolutely.
And someone, whoever it is, someone is counting on a group of people to not have done their homework or their research enough to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Every time anyone runs for, I will say this, and then I know we got to wrap it up. I will say this: anyone who runs for any public office, no matter how small it is, no matter how big it is, does have a level of a healthy, at best, a healthy ego. You have to, that whole idea of you looking and saying, I am passionate enough to take my name and make it into a brand for this entity, whether it's a city or state or national level, you have to be secure enough, at least in your understanding of the ideas, in order to do that. So that does take a little bit of an ego.
Right.
And Kanye West definitely has that.
Hey, he wrote a song about it. Like to hear it, here it go. I got a big ego. So he wrote a song about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But at the same time, so I mean, that's definitely there. But at the same time too, anyone who runs for any type of office, if they're legitimate about it, they think about that. They've looked at the history. They looked at, okay, how do people get elected? How do people put together their committees? How do people organize for this? Even someone like a Mike Bloomberg, who came in late when he ran this time around, what they're banking on is, yes, I can supersede some of the normal processes because I have more money or more resources at my disposal. But we mm-hmm. see how well that turned out for him.
Yeah.
So if it turned out the way it did for him, getting involved in the process as late as he did,
mm-hmm.
certainly it would be that way for Kanye West.
Yeah,
I'll say this as we wrap things up. I do believe all of us do need to consider not only getting more actively involved in some ways or another, but trying to find ways that we can even maybe run for offices. We need more people, particularly more people of color, to run for offices, even if they are in suburban communities or the only cookie or the only chip in the cookie. They, mm-hmm. we have to do that because we have to make sure that we have our voices out there. And so, you know, I'm looking at some different opportunities here in the near future where I'm going to be organizing opportunities for people to talk about that and say, hey, I'm interested. I just don't know where to start. I don't want to be a Kanye West and just do it and then find out that I'm doing it all wrong. Here's an opportunity for folks to say, maybe it's next year, maybe it's 2 years from now. I don't know. But how does this process work? Because I want to know more about how to do it so that I can get involved with it.
That's dope. And I think that you would be the perfect guy to launch something like that too, man. So we're definitely looking forward to seeing how that pans out. And we're gonna be following you along the way, brother. And so I'm going to include all of your tags and all that stuff in the description of this episode. But real quick, man, why don't you just throw out one of your social media handles or just a quick way to access you should anyone have any question about some of the diversity and equity training that you do or just some of the political stuff.
Yeah, we're actually revising our website right now, so hopefully it might be up by the time this launches or shortly the week after. That's equityandjusticeconsulting.com, but the Twitter handle is always the best. The Twitter handle is Isaiah McGee, ISAIAHMCGEE. I'm on IG as well, Instagram, and that's IC McGee. And I think on LinkedIn, it's also Isaiah McGee. So the hardest part that people have is Isaiah can sometimes be a hard name. So I just remind people there's two A's and an I in the middle of that A, ISAIAH. So you can follow me on Twitter, you can follow me on Instagram, you can follow me on LinkedIn as well.
Nice. All right. Well, hey, well, we appreciate your time and thanks again for stopping by on the Only Chip in the Cookie podcast.
I appreciate it.
Hey, this is Larry from Iowa, host of the Only Chip in the Cookie podcast. And hey, if you enjoyed what you heard, please consider donating. We want to take the podcast to another level. Would love to invest in some better microphones and some mixing equipment and computers and stuff like that. So please consider donating to the Cash App link below. And we look forward to delivering even better content to you guys. Thanks.